We're going to go from high-tech to extremely low-tech and talk about xenodiagnosis. Xenodiagnosis was developed in 1914 to diagnose Chagas disease, and it's still used today. And it's the most sensitive assay for Chagas disease, and they still feed triatoma bugs on patients to detect the presence of a trypanosoma cruzi in seropositive patients. Recently, they've started using xenodiagnosis for Chagas disease to identify reservoirs of trypanosoma cruzi. And in this paper just came out recently, they were looking at this spiny-tailed rat, Octodon digus. And you can see they did PCR on blood. I don't like this pointer here. It's just really couldn't. When they did PCR on blood, all 35 animals were negative. Well, 35 animals were negative. When they fed these tritone bugs on these animals and did PCR on their gut contents, you see that a certain percentage of them were positive. So that's how sensitive this assay is. These trypanosomes really like bugs. So I'm going to talk to you about tick-borne diseases, particularly Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a vector-borne zoonosis and involves this pathogen here, Borrelia burgdorferi, a spirochete, which is transmitted to Paramyscus leucopus, the white-footed mouse, which is the main reservoir, by Ixodes scapularis ticks. Everyone knows this, should know this. I'm talking entomologists here, you should know this stuff. So these, just in case you're not an entomologist, these ticks are a lot like bugs. They only feed once per stage. So larval ticks will feed, drop off, and molt into nymphs. Nymphs will do the same thing and get adults. And this is what the little different stages look like. So what we know about these ticks, this particular tick species, comes from actually drag sampling in the environment. It's the only time we can find them when they're out host seeking. And the larvae have a peak host-seeking activity here in September, and those larvae that molt to find a host and molt to nymphs will overwinter, diapause, and appear next spring as nymphs. Adults are in the spring and in the fall. So it has a two-year life cycle. Obviously, you have nymphs before larvae, and this is an important aspect. This phenology, host-seeking phenology, is really critical. Because these ticks are not born with infection, they have to acquire infection. And they acquire infection from reservoir hosts. So infected nymphs feed on these reservoir hosts, infect them just in time for the next generation of larvae to come out. And so the pathogens pass very efficiently from one generation to the next that way. And that's really the only way that it's maintained. So all the action here is passing the spirochetes or even some of the other tick-borne pathogens from nymphs to larvae through a reservoir host community. And the nymphs are pretty important epidemiologically. This is a nymphal stage tick feeding on a person. This is the main stage responsible for all the cases of tick-borne diseases, including Lyme disease, you see. Well, xenodiagnosis for iscapularis reservoirs, people have been doing that for 20 years. A paper we did a while ago looking at the reservoir status of Paramyscus leucopus as a striped skunk raccoon. And so we collected these things in September when they were full of larvae, and then we allowed these larvae to drop off and molt to the nymphal stage, and then we assayed those nymphs, did it by DFA then, for an Borrelia infection. So we looked at this many ticks from this many hosts, and this we found this many xenopositive nymphs. And so from the 12 paramyscus we looked at, we got an average of 40% positive, and xenotics, which range from, some of them got none, and some of them 100% of the ticks got on them or became infected. So skunks are much less reservoir competent, as are raccoons. And we also assayed flat larvae just to see if there were spirochetes in the larvae, because we were getting field collected material, and at that time we didn't know anything about, well, we suspected there might be some transurethral transmission or bits and reports of it, but you know, all 48 larvae were negative. So we since done a lot more work. Instead of working exclusively with field material, we established quite a sizable colony of Ixodes scapularis. These are adult scapularis, just several hundred there. And we feed them on New Zealand white rabbits, put little baby socks on the ears, and put about 20 ticks per ear. Allow the ticks feed for about 7 days. They feed to repletion, drop off, and lay eggs. And then we have larvae. We take these larvae and feed them on anesthetized mice. These happen to be Paramyrstis leucippus. We have a colony of those. We anesthetize them, put the larvae on them, put them over these pans of that are suspended above water, and then after the repletion, these larvae fall off into this little bath, and then we get some undergraduates to go and chew all that stuff and try to see if they can find these little engorged larvae, right? And I don't know if undergraduates aren't going to do it. I look at high school students pretty soon do that kind of stuff. So we get quite a bit. We feed larvae, or feed nymphs the same way. So we can generate quite a few ticks this way. We can store these ticks in an environmental chamber. We put them at 21 degrees centigrade to get them to they molt. And then if we want to store them for a while, we can put them in 8 degrees centigrade. And we can actually store nymphs for up to 2 years at 8 degrees. So we can stockpile a lot of ticks. We can infect them with different pathogens. We can take any kind of a tick-borne pathogen, put it in a mouse, put larval ticks on it, generate a bunch of infected nymphs, and store them in the environmental chamber, and hundreds of them are ready to go for any kind of experiment you want to do. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about three tick-borne pathogens: Borrelia burgdorferi, the agent of Lyme disease; Anaplasma phygocytophthalum, the agent of human granulocytic verticillosis; and Babesia microti, which is sporozoan and malaria-like disease, all transmitted by Ixodes scapularis. So when we feed these, a nymph on an animal and it gets infected, we do xenodiagnostic assays on them at weekly intervals. And so this is what the profile of the xenopositive ticks looks like for two pathogens. This is Anaplasma phygocytophthalum. So with the 7 days after they're infected, we can get about 40% of these things infected. But the infection prevalence wanes over time due to immunity. This is a self-limiting disease, and the animals don't stay persistently infected. With Borrelia burgdorferi, obviously they do. They stay infected pretty much for life and yield high numbers of xenodiagnostic ticks. So it's a good reservoir for this particular pathogen. But we can do more than that. We can look at pathogen fitness. And pathogen fitness can be looked at as the number of secondary infections resulting from a primary infection. This is typical of the Anderson-May epidemiologic models, and the concept of net reproductive rate in population ecology, or R-naught. So how many secondary infections will a primary infection cause? We put an infected nymph on a mouse and then put uninfected larvae on them. We can actually measure, you know, R-naught in different situations. So what is it? If we get one infected tick, if you don't get any, then it's zero and the infection is not going to be maintained. If we get one infected, then you can at least keep the infection going. One nymph produces one infected larvae, which molts to a nymph. Or get three or five. So you can measure that. So if we look at this graph again and look at this data in terms of R-naught, we can sum up. Let's go back here. I mean, we put about 100 ticks on it, but it doesn't really matter how many put on. You're looking at a percentage here. And these are all kind of theoretical values, but they're comparable, one with the other. So if we look at all the xenoticks we get from those assays, we get 114 infected ticks from a single, infection caused by a single nymph for HGE, and 516 for Borrelia burgdorferi. So Borrelia burgdorferi has a relative fitness 4.5 times higher than than anaplasma. And we see a much higher prevalence of infection in ticks than we do of Borrelia than we do anaplasma, certainly. But we can do other kinds of experiments with this system. We can look at interactions between pathogens. So here's an experiment where we looked at the interactions between anaplasma, or HGE, and Borrelia. And so here's our groups of mice. We could infect two groups here with the agent of HGE. After 10 days, we put larvae on them, and just to make sure they're infected, this is kind of a xeno. We just let them assays on the PCR assays on the engorged larvae. We don't want to wait for them to molt, but you know they're infected. Then we did reciprocal infections. Once we're infected with HGE, we put Borrelia on, and for controls, we put another infected with HGE on it. And then we did a series of xenoassays after that. This is a reciprocal experiment. Now we put 12 on it, and theoretically, one infection causes the same, as the same course, one infected nymphs that delivers the same course of infection as several do. But a lot of times we don't have a high enough prevalence. Say we have 50% prevalence in our anaplasma ticks, infected ticks, we'd have to throw half the mice away, and that's an expensive experiment. So we make sure that they're infected. So, where'd it go? What happened? Okay. All right, so the outcome of this is kind of interesting. If you look at the middle bar, these are xenoassays for HGE. And then the middle bar was what you saw before. Infection wanes, the back. So that's HGE only. If you add Borrelia to it after a week, you get pretty much the same profile. But if these animals are infected with Borrelia first, and you put anaplasma on them, you get less of yields. So anaplasma is less fit in a mouse that's already infected with Borrelia, which is kind of interesting. And if you assay them for Borrelia, you have the same kind of phenomena. Here's Borrelia alone. Here's Borrelia with HGE added later, and these are pre-infected with Borrelia. So a mixed infection seems to, depends on who's in there first, but the second one in there suffers a bit in fitness. And presumably there's some cross-reactive antibodies between these two paths, even though they're unrelated. There's some evidence, clinical evidence for cross-reactive antibodies. So in this situation, one has an antagonistic effect on the other's fitness. But if you look at Babesia, you get really a different situation. It's kind of interesting. Babesia, this is Babesia only. Babesia doesn't come up. This is kind of a short experiment. Student did this, had to finish it in the semester, so I won't carry the xenos out very far. But the you don't get xenopositive and Babesia infected ticks within 7 days. You get them in 14 days. But if they're previously infected with anaplasma, you get infection, xeno positive ticks right away, and the other infection is even worse. So in this instance, a mixed infection seems to be advantageous to the pathogen, or at least for Babesia. And if you look the other way, this is the assay for anaplasma, you get kind of the same results. Anaplasma usually wanes at day 14, but with a Babesia infection, it doesn't wane so much and it persists. And that's because both of these pathogens are actually immunosuppressive. So one pathogen is in there, it cannot mount its vigorous immune response against the second one. So these kind of pathogens have positive and negative interactions. So you can carry this a little bit further and look at different genotypes of specific pathogens. And Borrelia burgdorferi is quite variable. Here's one classification this one has 11 different outer surface protein C groups. And this is some interesting work done quite recently. There's a greater diversity of OSC Borrelia in ticks than you find in patients. These are from erythema migrans patients. That's the skin lesion that's caused characteristic of Lyme disease. And some of these genotypes, or OSPA types, we've seen in ticks, we've never seen in patients. And consequently, some of these genotypes we see in erythral migrans, we don't see in disseminated infections. The disseminated infections are infections. These are from blood isolates or organ isolates. Most of the cases of Lyme disease is confined to the skin, and it resolves quite easily. It's a lot of it's self-resolving, but some patients go have a hard time with internal organs. And it looks like it's because of the genotype that they were exposed to. So we can do another mixed infection experiment using different strains of the same organism. So this is the strain BL206, which is a low non-disseminated strain, and this is a highly disseminated strain. So we do the same kind of experiment. Initially infect the mice with one, and then put the second infection on them. Follow the infection through with a series of xenodiagnoses. And so this is kind of an interesting result. This I told you a lie. I mixed them around. This is 206. This is the more highly disseminating strain. Oops. Oops. And this is the skin. These are isolates from patients. The isolates from patients. Put them in mice. Put larval ticks on them. And then we have them in nymphs. We can play around with them. The one does really well in mice. The other one doesn't do so well. And when they're mixed infections, there's an interaction going on here. It's changed the trajectory of this pathogen with the presence of this one. And again, if you look at fitness, it looks like the 246 has a fitness of 50% higher than the other one. I mean, it's enough to make a pretty big difference. So in competition, 348 is not going to do too well, and we don't see that particular strain. It's more of a rare strain. And again, these strains have really profound clinical outcomes, and we're trying to understand, what causes the distribution of certain genotypes in tick populations. So there's quite a bit of diversity in Brelli-Burgdorferi. This is a genetic scheme devised by several different investigators, our lab and some other labs. And so we've looked at these two. We've looked at interaction between these two pathogens, but we have all these other ones to look at. This is like decades worth of work here, just looking at interactions of these pathogens. But believe me, it's important. We really need to understand. It's not just whether the ticks are infected. It's what genotypes in there is going to cause a lot of clinical illness. And there seems to be some geographic patterns to these prevalence of these different genotypes too, which is kind of interesting. All right, come on. This thing is not cooperating. There we go. Well, there's another application of xenodiagnosis that I want to tell you about. And that is that there's a little bit of controversy you might be aware of with the treatment of Lyme disease and whether Lyme disease is chronic infection or not. Quite a bit of controversy about that. A few subpoenas have been thrown around as well. So we did this kind of interesting experiment. We used C3H mice because for human analogs in the laboratory, because they are susceptible to some of the clinical things we see, particularly joint swelling and things we see with Lyme disease. So we infected some mice with the N40 strain, which is a tick isolate from New York. And then we let them go for 30 days. So this infection was very well established. Then we treated them. Okay, we treated them with doxycycline, which is oral, put it in drinking water. And then also with other mice, we treated them with ceftriaxone. We gave them three times a day subcutaneous. Ceftriaxone is usually given to patients intravenously. Doxycycline is the first recommended antibiotic treatment. And if patients don't resolve with doxy, they put them on ceftriaxone for a month or so. So this is pretty rigorous treatment for these mice. I mean, these are just little mice, and their life isn't very much long compared to ours. And then we did xenos at 1, 3, 6, and 9 months. And then we sacrificed them, and then we did tissue PCR and culture at the end of the experiment. So, interesting, at the end of the experiment, we looked at these animals and did PCR on these joints. And so the uninfected animals were, you know, all uninfected, as we expect. Those that got sham saline treatments were all infected, okay, all the way through. And then histopathology was pretty good on most of them, in terms of heart and joint, but spark did some damage. But in the ceftriaxone-treated mice, we still had half the animals we could PCR. We get PCR, positive PCR from the bladder. Everything else was zero. No histopathology or anything. And from doxy, it looked even the worst. We got quite a bit of PCR positivity in these, but no cultures. No culture positive. So these things, so they're culture positive, we're getting PCR results. And what does that mean? The animal infected? They're not. So we also did xenos on them, as I said, and we had xeno results for months 1 and 3, but later xeno attempts were all negative. These are the uninfected ones, of course, infected. The sham controls, positive controls here, we have 72% of the xeno ticks were positive at 1 month and 67% at 3 months. But in the treated mice, it's kind of interesting. 21% after a month, treatments after a month after the treatment, 21% was still xeno positive, and 36% in 3 months. Pretty high for the doxy. So, are they infected? I mean, you can do PCR and just get some extraneous DNA. It doesn't mean there's a living organism there. But if they're getting in ticks, they must be alive, right? Sparkies are mortal. Get into the tick, they got to be alive to be able to do that. So what does that mean? Well, if we let those ticks molt and let them feed on an animal to see if they can cause infection, if these organisms are infectious, we find that only the saline ones, untreated ones, have the xenopositive ticks that can actually transmit the Borrelia. So what's happening? It's kind of interesting. This challenges the whole notion of cure. Is cured or aren't they cured? Well, they seem to be, they're clinically fine, but they have some Borrelia in them, but the Borrelia are not infectious. And they did some more work, and they lost quite a few of their plasmids, half the genomes and plasmids, and so, you know, they lose plasmids, they're not very dangerous. So this is kind of an interesting experiment. Using xeno technique on this has been very, very revealing. You wouldn't know this stuff any other way other than by using this technology developed in 1914. So we're going to use xenos on patients. Make a lot of money. Ticks are cheap. And a lot of people want to be tested for Lyme disease. I've thought about it. But I wouldn't recommend it. An experiment we did a number of years ago, and Glenn Scholes back there in the room who actually did this work, we came up with a bunch of positive ticks and some supposedly negative control xeno ticks in the experiment. And so we looked around to see where these things came from. Well, first of all, what they were. And it turns out it's a spirochete that's not a Lyme disease spirochete. This is a Lyme disease group down here. Certain ones of these cause Lyme disease, but these are all Lyme disease Borrelia that have been known. There's a few new ones now, but they form a distinct cluster. These are relapsing fever spirochetes, which you've known about for a long time. And so this organism is very closely related to Borrelia miyamotoi, isolated from Ixodes persicatus in Japan. And it clusters here with a bunch of other of these relapsing fever Borrelia that are supposed to be in soft ticks, but some of these are Lone Star eyes from Amblyopia americanum, and Borrelia tyleri is from cattle ticks. So this little cluster here are a bunch of relapsing fever spirochetes that have found their way in the hard ticks. not much known about. Quite a bit about parvovirus, but this thing hardly is known about. Nothing's known about this. Myomotoi. So, where'd it come from? Well, they're transverially maintained. We went back to our colony, figured out where these things came from, and turns out that these females we brought in from Brantford, Connecticut, two of them were infected with this new spirochete. 66% of larvae were infected, and 73% of larvae were infected in this clutch. The spirochete maintained in skid mice, and you see spirochetes all over these blood of these mice. Relapsing fever is a pretty nasty disease, gets into the brain. It's completely cryptic. There's no diagnostic method for this. It's not going to cross-react with Borrelia burgdorferi. PCRs, primers for Borrelia, are not going to work on it. You can't culture it. So if it wasn't infected with it, you'd never have done that. So, don't use ticks for xenodiagnosis on humans.